Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is...
Neat!
It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
Well, this is our first time recording together since the start of the pandemic.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. We both got tested, and we are both negative for COVID, and Taylor has antibodies. I don't have antibodies. I wish I did. And because of the circumstances, Taylor living alone and have been isolating this whole time, because of those circumstances, we are actually okay. Fairly okay to be in the same room because I cannot give it to them, and they have been very responsible and don't live with anyone else, so.
Yes. Can't give it, can't get it.
Yeah.
There you go.
And we're going to keep getting tested so that we know our status.
Yeah. And, I, obviously, how long antibodies last, we don't really know for sure with this yet. We're still dealing with presumptions based on similar viruses, so. Mm-hmm. Also, just because I think it's important, we'll continue practicing, like wearing a mask and following all the things that I'm supposed to do.
Yes, absolutely. We're not going to go out and gather with other people.
Nope, no gatherings.
Keep limiting our exposure and wear a mask when social distancing is not possible. So that's what we're doing. And that's what everyone should be doing still.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's a weird time. I mean, I know in the rest of the country, a lot of people are in phase three. Restaurants are open. There's spacing between seatings. There's some rules in place. But I'm already hearing from my restaurant friends in other parts of the country that it's kind of a nightmare. So I don't know. I mean, I'm a bartender. I rely on people going to bars. But I kind of wish we weren't. Kind of wish we weren't doing it so quickly. I think it's gonna be bad, and the people that are gonna have to go back to work are gonna be putting themselves in danger.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just because things didn't open up because it is okay now. Things opened up because the economy was in danger of collapsing. So just remember, just because things are opening up doesn't mean it's safe. Because the government does not give a fuck. So.
Yeah. I think you can continue to support your favorite local restaurants by, getting those to-go cocktails, getting food to go, maybe tip a little more if you can afford to. But as far as sitting down at restaurants, I don't think it's what we should be doing right now. So.
I agree.
I don't know. I'm saying this is somebody that's very soon going to be forced to go back out and work.
Right.
And I kind of wish I didn't have to. So, just be responsible. But hey, it's Pride Month.
Yeah, it is. So we wanted to revisit a topic that we actually talked about the last Pride episode we did last year. It was our second episode ever. So, you guys knew what we're about way up front. So we wanted to talk again about Stonewall, but this time highlight the heroes of Stonewall, the actual people and their lives and what they were like.
Yeah. I think one thing we've learned over a little over a year doing this podcast is that sometimes it's better to have a digestible amount of information, mm-hmm. sort of with room for discussion, versus our first Pride episode was a lot. It was like, let's talk about the entirety of Stonewall and everything leading up to it, and also a completely different.
Yeah, like, we recorded the Pride episode twice.
We did
because we I think actually I was so nervous about it the first time we recorded because I just wanted to get it right, and I we wanted to present it in a way that would be really informative and easy to listen to, and also like completely factual. And also, like, there are things that things that we said that we understood as just like we believe in queer culture, that like I think everyone has done a little bit more fact checking now and going back into archives and figuring out mm-hmm. more about what happened. So like we're going to talk a little bit about that too, but that's like not necessarily, I mean, it's some of it's misinformation that everybody kind of believed, but it's still important for the legacy. So we'll talk about that. You'll know what I'm talking about in a minute.
Wow. We're going to talk about three figures that are associated strongly with the start of the Stonewall riots, protests, revolution.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I asked if I could talk about my favorite of the three, and Liz was kind enough to let me.
yeah, I love it.
But so one of the central figures, she might have been the one to kick it all off. We'll get into maybe nots in a second. But I want to talk about Storm Delavier. Say that right?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
It's French, so you say it completely differently than how it's spelled. Mm-hmm. And I think actually the last time that we talked about it last year, I'm pretty sure I said it completely wrong. And I really tried to like do research and figure out how to say it. No, I still said it wrong.
We both did.
It's you know.
There's a storm is spelled Storme with an accent mark, and mm-hmm. I think that we both read that as Storme.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do. But as far as we know from the information that we've gathered recently, Storm herself pronounced it that way. Uh-huh. So
in an interview she phonetically sounded out her name and said Storm. But all right, so Storm was born in 1920. She was born to a white father and an African-American mother. Her mother actually worked for her father's family at the mm-hmm. time. And now this was back when like interracial marriage was illegal, so
yeah,
she didn't even get a birth certificate. Storm never actually knew when her actual birthday was. She chose to celebrate it on December 24th, which I love.
I'm into it. Yeah. It's a great date.
I'm just like, so I'm gonna move forward. Like, I don't know how I feel about religion. I'm just gonna now, Christmas is, oh, that's when we celebrate like queer icon Storm Delavier, right?
I think that's good. I think that it's actually smart to celebrate your birthday at least like close to Christmas, because then you can just be like, oh, all these people being merry are celebrating me.
You know?
It's yeah. about me.
I mean, I think, you know, yeah.
People are willing to get together anyway. If you just have a big party.
Yeah. If you're disenchanted with Christmas, then, you know, maybe just make it a celebration of this lesbian icon.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm down with that. I'm going to do that every Christmas Eve from now on.
This is a Storm Delavier day. But Storm had a rough childhood. You know, she was biracial, so she was harassed and bullied throughout her childhood. I mean, it's brutal stuff. Several accounts, like, you know, she had like a leg brace as a result of being beaten up. Like, she had a scar from where kids hung her on a fence and just left her there.
Oh my God.
And bullied by white people and black people alike. And her father, who feared for her safety, sent her away to a private school.
Okay. Probably a good call.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sucks for the time. Yeah, that just sucks.
Yeah, you know, but like, hard upbringing. I thought this was cool. She spent some time as a teenager riding horses with the Ringling Brothers Circus.
Yeah, she was an equestrian.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool.
I think she had an injury that kind of ended that right. career for her. But that's a hell of yeah. a thing to do. Like, just... Like, before she was 18, right? She was riding horses.
And she had to write because you know, she was a woman. She had to ride side saddle. And that actually was one of the things that was really hard on her body. That's, like, apparently when you ride side saddle and, like, do, like, jumping horses, it's very hard on your bones.
Mm.
to do it like that. So it's like fucking crazy to think about, like, that's like the ladylike version of it, but like it's more dangerous to ride that way.
That would be like driving a car sitting like sideways in the passenger seat
with your legs out the window.
Yeah, that's some rough stuff. That was ladylike. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, she figured out that she was gay around the age of 18, and she, you know, decided that she would probably be murdered for being gay in the South, so she should move elsewhere. So she moved to Chicago.
Cool.
Yeah. She began a singing career. Originally, she began her singing career, you know, just performing as a woman, and she used the stage name Stormy Dale.
Okay.
Yeah. And then she was visiting some friends in Miami when she was introduced to the Jewel Box Review, which was like a touring drag review. Yes. It was the first integrated drag show in America.
Oh, so, progressive.
Yeah, and they were an integrated cast, and they performed to integrated audiences. So,
oh, that's really revolutionary. Yeah,
very, very important for its time. And a lot of people warned her against it. She was offered a place in this, a position at it. And a lot of her friends were like, no, doing drag is bad for your career. People won't take you seriously. You'll be associated with, I don't know, I guess, a bad scene of ill repute. But she said, nah, I'm going to do it for like 6 months, see how it is.
Yeah.
And by 6 months, she meant 14 years.
Okay.
So she joined the Jewel Box Review. She became their iconic male MC. So, you know, she would wear these perfectly, like, suits, like sharp style. Mm-hmm. She just like cut like an amazing figure,
and she was the only woman in the company.
Yeah, the only drag king. And they would like, you know, like, I don't know, like anecdotally, they would like play like, oh, which one of our cast members do you think is a real woman? And no one would ever guess that it was the male MC.
Oh my god, that's so cool. Yeah, because they were like the Jewel Box Review was all like self-identified drag queens. Yes. They were like, we are men dressing in women's clothing.
Yeah. And she was just like, just the one, you know, like leading the event. Like,
yes.
And I love like her discussing of like she didn't do any like kind of like, she was just herself. She didn't change the way she walked. She didn't really change the way she talked. Like, mm-hmm. she had an amazing vocal range. Like, she could sing as a baritone.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. And that actually one thing that she, so her success, because she was a massive success, she was beloved as her role in the Jewel Box Review, and she like put her in circles of some of her favorite singers at the time, people like Dinah Washington and Billie Holiday.
Fuck yes. Yeah,
which, okay. I have to say, Dinah Washington's album A Stranger on This Earth is a I got it at like a thrift shop forever ago, and it's like one of my, I'd say top five, if not maybe my number one. Like, that's what I want to like have a stiff cocktail and like feel feelings to.
Yes. I love listening to some Dinah Washington. Oh
my god, the song Me and My Gin. Like, if you just need a song to like sip a cocktail to and feel like angry about something, it's the best. So Stormy had massive success, stayed with the company for a long time. Became like a fashion icon alongside of that. You know, when we talk about like the like development of the burgeoning scene of like out visible lesbians, mm-hmm. like she was like, she didn't just leave her drag behind when she left stage. She wore her suits around town.
Right. She was like wearing it on the streets of New York. And that's like, I think that's like a really important thing to highlight, because as we've mentioned our last episode about Stonewall, at the time, in the 50s and 60s, you could just be arrested for if they believed you were impersonating the opposite sex. Mm-hmm. So she must have pulled it off, too.
Yeah.
But that also inspired other lesbians to dress masculinely. And I mean, I guess, like, you know, like, it's like a very, it's a very revolutionary stance. You know, you're kind of putting yourself at risk to, in order to, like, express who you are.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the exactly. Like, it wasn't just a stage costume for her. It was part of her identity. And, you know, a lot of times we talk about these historic queer figures, there's a lot of questions about like if they had language at the time, how they would have identified. But just for clarification, like, Storm was a very clear, proud, she, her lesbian. Yes. So that, those were her pronouns. That's how she identified. This, but this was just her style. This was a style she adopted and mm-hmm. kept through her life.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the events of June 28th, 1969, it would sort of rock the world and the queer scene for forever. Now, what Storm's place is in the riot is up for debate. She was definitely there. I think we could say...
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
She was there. There are a lot of alternative stories here. Some people say... Like, a lot of people do point to that there is a, like, a butch lesbian mm-hmm. that started things off. So, right. you know, as we talked about, like, the Stonewall Riot started with a police raid at, like, 1 a.m. Police raids on gay bars were normal, but usually because a lot of... I mean, Stonewall was owned by the mafia. A lot of these gay bars were also owned by the mafia. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of an agreement between police and the bar owners that they would have the raids at times where the bar wasn't crazy packed.
Yeah.
So having a raid at 1 o'clock in the morning was pretty... Like, you were going to get a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so they had this raid. So the story goes that Storm was there, you know, dressed to the nines... In a great suit, and a cop, as they were, like, getting everybody out of the bar, said, move along, F word. I'm not going to say that. But in response, because she passed, so the cop right. just thought she was a young man.
Mm-hmm.
So in response, she punched the cop.
Yes.
Which led to her being cuffed. As she was being, like, wrestled into the police car, she kind of kept, like, the crowd was gathering. She was slipping through the crowd. She, like, escaped the cops a few times. And she asked people, like, what was it? Why don't you do something?
Yeah, why don't you, like, a bunch of people were just standing around because some people had been, like, decided that they're not going to be arrested and they were released. So, but the crowd, they just hung around to see what was happening. And then more people joined. So there was a big crowd around. And she said, you know, you're just standing around. Why doesn't one of you do something? Mm-hmm.
That led to, you know, the first bottle, that I guess the second punch maybe, but, you know, that it was a butch lesbian that made the call to people to react mm-hmm. to what was happening.
Yeah, some accounts say that the crowd just started throwing whatever they could find. And there was also, I think this is fun to mention because somebody had suggested that the reason why the cops were raiding was because they weren't. They hadn't been paid, so they started throwing pennies and, like, pelting the cops with pennies. Like,
that's great.
Here you go. Pay them.
I love that. Well, yeah, and, you know, I like her words on Stonewall because, you know, there was a period where she said that maybe, like, she wasn't a part of it, and then she did in a lot of later documentaries and interviews say, like, no, I was there. And, I mean, a lot of people placed her there.
Mm-hmm.
But she said of it that... She didn't like it being called a riot. She said it was a rebellion. It was an uprising. It was a civil rights disobedience. It wasn't mm-hmm. no damn riot.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, so obviously in whatever is true to the story, I think that she played a prominent role
yes.
in the events that unfolded at Stonewall.
Definitely.
Now, after the riots, Storm's girlfriend of 25 years, she lived with this dancer by the name of Diana, had been her life partner. They'd met when they were young. They'd been together. Diana passed away. And after that, Storm retired from show business
mm-hmm.
Somewhat. She kept a picture of Diana on her up until the day she died.
Aww.
Yeah. She went on to serve as a bouncer to the most iconic lesbian bars in New York City. She was a bouncer at the original Cubbyhole. Now, there is still a Cubbyhole in New York City. It is not the same one.
Right, it moved.
Yeah, the Cubbyhole moved, but the old Cubbyhole became Henrietta Hudson's,
mm-hmm.
which is still there. And Storm was a door person at both.
Yeah.
The original Cubbyhole and then Henrietta Hudson when it took over. And she really was just sort of like the fairy god lesbian of
yes, she was young like a protector. Kids.
She was.
Well, I found it really cool to read that, like, she actually didn't really like the term bouncer. She preferred, like, babysitter.
Yeah.
The young gays and lesbians. And she was actually, because she kind of worked, like, double time. She was like a bodyguard mm-hmm. for rich families during the day, and then at night she was a security guard at the most famous lesbian bars. But, like, she worked at Henrietta Hudson until 2005. She was 85
yeah.
years old.
No, That's crazy for me to think. I mean, I guess I had just moved to New York, and I definitely went to, like, Cubbyhole and Henrietta Hudson when I was a baby. And I I definitely didn't cross. I feel like I would have remembered something, right. But it's crazy to think that I had, like, a little bit of an overlap with such an iconic.
Yeah.
We talk about these people and we think this is the past, right? It's like, no, like, these were... This is recent history.
She was still around.
And it's only recently, really, in the scale of things, that we've had the rights that we enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But, like you said, like she was a babysitter. along with being a babysitter, she also served on the Stonewall Veterans Association. She was the chief of security, an ambassador. She was eventually the vice president. She was a regular at Gay Pride Parade. She helped raise funds for homeless youth. She threw benefits for battered women and children and abuse victims.
Mm-hmm.
She was really focused on the plight of, like, homeless youth, on the poor, on women's rights. And when asked why, she responded, just someone has to care.
Yes.
And she was asked similarly in a 2001 documentary about her life. She said that, I'm a human that survived. I help other people survive.
That's beautiful.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah. She was like a vanguard for the community.
People call her the guardians of lesbians in the village.
Yes.
She passed away on May 24th of 2014. She was in a Brooklyn nursing home. None of her immediate family was still alive, but she was celebrated and, you know, beloved in the community. And I really want to read this bit from her obituary because I just think it's so fucking cool.
Yeah.
Tall, androgynous, and armed, she held a state gun permit. Miss Delevier roamed Lower 7th and 8th Avenue and points between into her 80s, patrolling the sidewalks and checking in at lesbian bars. She was on the lookout for what she called ugliness, any form of intolerance, bullying, or abuse of her baby girls. She literally walked the streets of downtown Manhattan like a gay superhero. She was not to be messed with by any stretch of the imagination.
Ugh.
So.
Storm.
Fucking badass.
What a fierce...
Style icon. Gay superhero.
Yes.
Helper of the helpless.
Legendary. Ugh. Yeah, her life is a beautiful story. I think that it's like... you know, I mean, with many of, like, our queer elders, it's like it's great that we're recognizing them now, and it's very sad how they weren't appreciated completely in their life. Like, I know Storm spent, like, her last years in a nursing home in, like, mm-hmm. not, like, the best conditions, and, you know, maybe if more of, like, the queer community, the younger queer community, like, knew more about her story, they would have come together and, like, raised some funds so that she could have lived more comfortably. But she was a legend and a real stand-up human being. So that's a reminder to take care of the people, our elders in our community now. There's fireworks outside. I don't know if you can hear it, but... Those are real firework displays.
That's what I'm telling you. Yeah. These are not. I've lived in Bushwick for 10 years now. This is not.
Yeah, it's not normal. It's not normal, but
it's a weird high amount of very expensive high quality fireworks in Brooklyn right now.
It's interesting.
A little weird. All right.
So, I want to talk about the other heroes of the Stonewall Uprising. And it's kind of hard to talk about one without the other, but I'm going to start with Sylvia Rivera, and she was known as the Latinx American gay liberation and trans rights activist, and she is famed to have thrown the first Molotov cocktail at the Stonewall Uprising. However, she did correct those claims, saying, right. I threw the second. And we'll get into this a little bit later. It's not really confirmed that any Molotov cocktails were thrown. And at the time, she might have been somewhere else. I'll get into that in a minute. However, like, in the terms of the movement at large, like, she should be credited with being one of the liberators.
Right. I agree. I think we centered so much on Stonewall and who was there and who wasn't there. And that can lead you to not focus on the important work that people did in the aftermath.
Absolutely.
And surrounding it.
Yes.
Stonewall was an event that set a lot of stuff off, but the leaders of it were the people that emerged and continued to protect and support the community.
Right. Yeah. That's very true. That's very true. Because it's just kind of like we're seeing now. Like, it's one thing to have a protest, but you have to continue to do the work afterwards and keep the movement alive. So, Sylvia was born in New York City, July 2nd, 1951, and she came from parents that were Puerto Rican and Venezuelan, raised by her Venezuelan grandmother after her father abandoned the family and her mother committed suicide when Sylvia was just 3 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. So Sylvia, who at the time was called Ray, was a very effeminate child, began wearing makeup in the fourth grade, and her grandmother strongly disapproved. And actually, Rivera left home in 1961 at the age of 10, like baby. And she was on the street, hanging out mostly around 42nd Street, which was not a nice place to hang out at the time. And she had to resort to sex work as a child, but then was taken in by the local drag queens and given the name Sylvia. So she did find a community there. And so Stonewall happened. Sylvia was 17 at the time that Stonewall happened. And whether or not Sylvia or Marsha, for that matter, were actually there, there's a reason that they are part of the legend. Many Stonewall veterans wished for her to be included in the Stonewall story so that young Puerto Rican, and at the time they were called transvestites, they didn't have the language of transgender that we have today, and it was also not really understood as an identity, so they were called transvestites at the time, but they wanted to have her be a role model for those young Puerto Rican trans kids that were on the street, really. A lot of the homeless youth, the homeless queer youth were there. And I also want to clear up, when I say queer, I'm talking about the way that we use it today as the communal term, because back then queer was definitely a slur.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they wouldn't have used that word. But no one was looking out for the most vulnerable people in the community, which were the young gay people living on the street, the trans people, who were usually at the time referred to as drag queens or street queens, and the sex workers, and many of those people checking all of those boxes, really.
Right.
Those people would go missing. They might commit suicide or be murdered by Johns or murdered by pimps or murdered by cops, who really just only seem to be present to torture the community. And Sylvia...
What a weird time that was. Not at all like today.
Yep. Okay, well, y'all do the math. You know what's going on.
All cats are beautiful.
Sylvia joined the Gay Activists Alliance at 18 years old. This was in 1970. And her mission was to be a voice for the forgotten and tossed out members of her community. There was a big part of the gay liberation movement that wanted assimilation. And drag queens, as they called them, were not included in that vision.
Right.
Because they directly undermined what they were trying to put out as their image, basically. So, and she herself struggled with substance abuse, spent a lot of time living on the streets with the gay homeless community at the Christopher Street docks. So she really knew what it was like to be there. And she advocated for them and for the gay people who had been put in jail and had, like, no resources to get out. And she founded STAR in 1970, that same year, with Marsha, which stands for Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. STAR actually still exists to this day, and they have changed it to Street Transgender Action Revolutionaries to update it.
Right.
And they offered services for homeless gay youth, and they fought for the Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act, a very important bill, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation in employment, housing, public accommodations, education, credit, like basically everything you really need to, like basic human rights, things that you need to survive. Yeah, that like a person just could be denied those things just based on discrimination.
And they not only saw through like fighting for the original bill, but also adding a focus on transgender rights.
Yes, at the time, there was a portion of the bill that Sylvia herself advocated for that specifically included, and the language they used was drag queens and transvestites. Yeah, it was meant to be more deliberately protective of those people. The Gay Activist Alliance actually dropped those portions of the bill because they felt it wasn't possible to pass it with such quote, extreme elements included. The thing that was happening with the GAA at the time was they were becoming more conservative. Some of their founders and officers were trying to get into public office, like trying to get elected. So they actually changed their political agenda and excluded issues of trans people and drag queens. But even with them dropping those extreme sections of the bill, it still didn't pass until 1986. But we have that because Sylvia advocated for it. She was really pivotal in that. She would be like, kind of like the demonstrations that we're seeing today. The people on the front lines are the people who are the greatest risk. So she was on the front lines.
Right.
They had no problem putting her out there. And then if the press showed up, they'd switch out and like kind of push her off to the side and put one of the more like the people that fit their image
in palatable there. palatable gaze,
yes, white cis
male
gaze. Yes, exactly. And she was basically being marginalized by her own community, and she felt really hurt by that. She felt betrayed by the community, and rightly so.
Yeah.
There's actually, in 1973, at the Christopher Street Liberation Day rally in New York, she had been promised a spot to speak. They kept pushing her back because some of the organizers who were those more assimilation-favoring people, cis, white, male gays, they didn't want drag queens to have the focus because they thought that they would make the movement look bad. So Sylvia and another queen, Lee Brewster, jumped on the stage, and they were eventually given the mic despite some disagreement from the crowd. But even like if you watch this video, she's booed before she even starts speaking. When she did speak, she called out the lack of support from the white middle class gays who were leaving out members of their own community who were in jail and like doing nothing about it. And many people were in the crowd were cheering by the end of her speech, but she still felt really betrayed by that moment, and she left the movement after that. She actually moved out to the suburbs of Westchester for a while, and she performed in the local club where she felt appreciated there for liberating the minds of the people she came in contact with in that small club in Westchester. And she only returned to the city when she heard of Marsha P. Johnson's death. And she lived actually for a while in a handmade shelter on the edge of the Hudson River before they were all like the homeless population that was living there were forced to move out because they were renovating the piers.
Hmm.
But she returned to activism, and she encouraged transgender people, drag queens, and butch lesbians to fight for their legacy at the front of the movement. And she was actually acclaimed as the mother of all gay people.
The mother of gays.
The mother of gays at the Millennium March in 2000 in Italy. Oh. And it was like a really beautiful, like if you see that footage of that, it's a really beautiful moment where like there's just so many like all of these people from around the world gathered in Italy and just loving her and praising her. And she's finally like getting that recognition. I know I've already mentioned Marsha, but I got to start at the beginning and give her whole bio. So
yeah.
Marsha, pay it no mind, Johnson.
That is the best thing that the P could stand for.
Yes, that's it. And she's credited as the one to throw the first brick at the Stonewall Uprising. However, it's later, like she herself later said that she didn't get there until 2 a.m. in the right. morning, and the place was already on fire. So we'll get back to that in a minute again. So she was born in Elizabeth, New Jersey, August 24th, 1945. Mm-hmm. She started wearing dresses at the age of 5, but she stopped after being harassed by neighborhood boys and also reprimanded by her parents, who were very religious. She moved to Greenwich Village after graduating high school with $15 and a bag of clothes. And, yep, she was just, I gotta get out here. So, but she was homeless, and much like a lot of the homeless gay community, she had to resort to sex work to survive. But she did find a family in the Christopher Street nightlife, and she was very much a part of that scene. She was friends with Andy Warhol and all these celebrities, and she would come home to Jersey sometimes and talk to her sister and her family about, like, the celebrities she knew and all that, and they just thought that she was joking. But she actually knew all these people. She was photographed by Andy Warhol and very much part of his work too. So she eventually chose her name based on her love for Howard Johnson's The Eatery.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And the P stands for Pay It No Mind, which was kind of, it became her mantra to dismiss the haters, you know? Like, Marsha, pay it no mind, Johnson, like, let's not get into this. And she actually once said the phrase to a judge who released her because she, like, made him, he found it humorous, and so he released her. She was known for her body sense of humor and her outrageously ornate drag, and she identified herself as a drag queen. But like we've mentioned, the term transgender was not in use at the time. Really, like, when you get into, a lot of people have speculated who know a lot more about gender studies than I do, have speculated because of her attitude and her varied presentations, she may be more aligned with gender nonconforming individuals or gender fluid.
Right.
And she didn't do high drag or show drag because she didn't really have the funds to be able to do that. She dressed in whatever she found or she was given. And she would gather leftover flowers from under sorting tables in the flower district. And that's where she got her iconic flower crowns.
Yeah.
She made them.
Oh, I love that.
So she always had fresh flowers in her hair, her wig. And yeah, she liked to dress in a way that called attention. And she often, like, in her dress, she explored both masculine and feminine presentation in her style, which is really cool. Icon. She actually did frequent the Stonewall Inn only after they started allowing drag queens and women
right,
in.
Well, that was only slightly before the Stonewall, like,
yep.
The Stonewall Rebellion.
Yes.
There was an interview I listened to with Sylvia Rivera where she was talking about how there were other bars that were, like, safe for drag queens, but Stonewall wasn't necessarily one of those until very recently.
It was really only for gay men.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was named as one of the leaders of the uprising, but she herself denied this, saying that she only arrived after the rebellion had already begun about 2 a.m. and the place was already on fire. And there are accounts that she threw a shot glass at a mirror, breaking the mirror, screaming, "I got my civil rights."
Great moment.
Yeah, it's a great moment. It's legendary. But then she also herself said that she wasn't there at that time. Here's some info on that. There's also an idea that she may have been left out of accounts of the night when they finally, like, when they went back and recorded it from people who were confirmed to be there, because they might have feared if she was credited as starting the uprising that the image of that, the optics, would hurt the movement.
Right.
Well,
not right. Fucked up.
Yeah.
Accurate.
I mean, you know, regardless, she was part of it. And then there are several accounts that on the second night of the rebellion, Marsha climbed a lamppost and dropped a bag containing a brick onto a cop car, which shattered the windshield.
Nice.
And speaking of bricks and bags, apparently that was just something that she did, probably for self-defense. There was one time when she was being arrested for hustling, and she hit them with her bag containing two bricks. And instead of going to prison at the time, her lawyer was able to convince the judge that Bellevue would be more appropriate. Bellevue's a mental hospital here in New York. And she did struggle with mental health issues. She suffered from depression. She had mental breakdowns. But no doubt her high stress and housing insecure living situation, and her need to engage in sex work definitely, for like as a means for survival, affected her mental health. There's no disputing that.
How could you not? Like the amount of struggle and strife.
Of course, absolutely.
You're going to need therapeutic care after that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was something that she provided for a lot of other people, and she didn't really always get the means herself. But in 1970, she joined the Gay Liberation Front and participated in the first Christopher Street Pride rally on the anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. And she also helped Sylvia to found STAR. And the pair became very visible political figures. They participated in marches and radical demonstrations. And because of that, they were both banned from participating in the Gay Pride Parade in 1973 by the Gay and Lesbian Committee who were overseeing it, because they didn't want drag queens to participate. They thought it would, again, they thought that it would make the movement look bad. So their response to that was they decided to march right in front of the parade. Mm-hmm. And if you ever, if you've ever seen the iconic photo of Sylvia Rivera, she kind of like has her hand around her mouth because she's screaming, or she's like, she's chanting, she's calling something out. And Marsha's just right behind her. That photo is from the 1973 Pride Parade, where they decided to completely fucking go against what had been prescribed to them as the behavior that they were expected of. I mean, I don't know why anyone would expect them to just like, after being told they can't be in the Pride Parade, these two iconic figures that were so much part of the movement, like, that's insulting, but like, to just expect them to be like, okay, cool, we won't show up. Like, I don't know what they were thinking. Okay. Through their work with STAR, Johnson and Rivera helped so many homeless youth in the community. In 1972, they founded STAR House, which was a shelter for gay and trans street kids. And then Marsha was the drag mother of those children, even though they didn't participate in like competitions, as we know, like houses like that. They were really just like a safe space for the kids. And they actually, Marsha and Rivera, paid the rent there through their sex work. So they really were just like putting themselves out here for the community, you know, because nobody was taking care of these kids. So they put themselves on the line. And Marsha continued to be active in street activism until the 80s. She organized for ACT UP, which is the international grassroots political group working to end the AIDS pandemic. And she worked with them up until her death in 1992. Now, I will talk about her death because it's very much, it's just so relevant and is still relevant today. Right. Despite her mental health concerns, her death was highly suspicious. Her body was found in the Hudson River shortly after the Pride Parade of 1992, and it was ruled as a suicide by the police. And there was hardly any investigation. They just decided that it wasn't worth looking into, which is something that still happens to a lot of trans women of color, black and brown trans people. All of Marsha's friends were convinced that she could not have committed suicide, and a reopening of her case and an individual investigation by Victoria Cruz of the Anti-Violence Project suggests that Marsha may have been targeted by the mob. It was something that she was really fearful of, because her roommate at the time, Randy Wicker, was very outspoken and critical of the mob's supposed control of the Christopher Street Festival. So they had the, you know, they had the march every year that was organized by the Pride Heritage Committee, but then the Christopher Street Festival was run by figures who were supposedly part of the mafia. And they, you know, Randy Wicker was like, well, we are not seeing any of those funds. Apparently, the Pride Heritage Committee had already tried to look into it and they were threatened. So she was very paranoid about the mafia being after her. It could, there's a lot of different theories, but she could have been chased, and possibly even at the very least, it's not... it doesn't make sense for it to be a suicide. It could have been an accident where she was chased and then she fell through the pier because it was dilapidated. Yeah. But it's a really important thing to to think about today, especially in the context of where we're at, because there's still so many people who are considered to be less important. Mm-hmm. And because of that, their deaths are not given the same weight mm-hmm. that other people's lives.
Well, and we're right in the middle of a situation where we have prominent leaders of protest movements, or people that just participated in them, or just Black people in general whose deaths are being ruled as suicide.
Yeah.
In things that look a lot like lynchings, and right. we're just calling them that. So the idea that we have, the idea that the controlling powers have given silent warnings to communities that might rise up against them via prominent figures' deaths is not, or it's not anything new in our country.
Yeah, it's not. The idea that an activist who is literally, like, all of their work is concerned with fighting for their right to survive, their right to live, would just commit suicide is really not just, like, insulting to their legacy, but, like, very telling.
Well, I mean, how far off are we from Martin Luther King being threatened with, quote-unquote, suicide if he didn't stop speaking out? I mean...
Right. It's all... Guys, it's all connected. You do the math. You do the math. You can see what's going on and what has been going on for a long time.
Well, and I think that this leads us to a conversation that I want to have about sort of the idea of what went on around Stonewall, the fight for gay rights, for recognition of queer people, of trans people. There are some parallels to what we're dealing with right now. But I think that it's interesting. You brought up talk about, like, assimilation, like having an approachable yeah. face on the gay rights movements in the 70s. That even goes back to before that, which the episode we did last year, we touched on the sip-ins, where mm-hmm. how else can you say it other than, like, approachable looking cis white gay males would go to nice establishments and performatively show that they can sit there and be respectable and have a drink and not be something to be afraid of?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think, like, the intentions were, like, well meant, because at the time of, like, the context of that was that it was, you could be arrested for, if you were known to be a homosexual and having a drink at a bar, you could be arrested for just being disorderly, even no, regardless of your behavior, just the fact that you were a homosexual and having a drink.
Right.
So there was an important point to be made there, but that, like, I think that really carried over into the goals of the people that were involved and saw that as, like, a means to get gay civil rights, even though that was, like, completely, that was disregarding the rest of the community. Right. Not everybody can assimilate in that way.
Well, and it's also, like, why should our goal be assimilation? Is mm-hmm. it, I can follow your rules and fit in with your society, so you shouldn't be afraid of me? Or is it that, no, I have my own identity and my own, like, society, and, like, that should just be recognized and be protected. I shouldn't have Absolutely. To follow your rules to exist. I mean, how often do we see that, like, people that are victims of police violence, the first thing they do is look at their life and they're put into this judgment of, like, well, what kind of person were they? It's like, nobody right. should have to be the perfect, most upstanding citizen to be allowed to exist in this world just because there's something about them that started them off as, like, a person of suspect.
Like, right, exactly. It's always, like, especially, I mean, we see it when there's violence against sex workers. They're always written off as, oh, well, they lived a high-risk lifestyle. That doesn't, well, okay, there's obviously, there's nuance in there, because they might be, like, they might be in a position where they're doing survival sex right. work and they don't really have a choice. They don't have the resources to be able to live a different lifestyle. But they're, like, regardless, no matter how they're living their life, they deserve to be alive. Like, the fact that that's up for debate is, that's insane.
Well, and the idea of assimilation also, it's like, it assumes like, so we have to look like you, we have to sound right. like you, we have to talk like you, we have to behave like you.
And not everybody can do that.
Yeah. I mean, that was, I think, a
physically.
Big, right. That was a thing that I had to come to understand about my own privilege, is that even though I don't like being perceived as a cis woman, I'm a white person, I'm able-bodied, I pass, and
right.
that I have always been able to adopt a role in jobs that is an allowable role. Like, I can perform femininity and have a place in society, and as much as that might make me uncomfortable, it's not, there's at least there's a place that I yeah. can, if I have to survive, I can fill a role.
Right.
We haven't made room in society for certain types of bodies, and that's deeply problematic.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a privilege being able to pass in that way, and not everybody can. So regardless of how uncomfortable or terrible it feels inside, which I neither of us are disputing that is a legitimate feeling and problem. That's a struggle. That's an internal struggle that is very, very real, but it is not a struggle that actually puts you in physical danger mm-hmm. of being harmed by other people.
And that's such a, I mean, that like the idea that this, I think we have this fantasy of like the gay rights movement being like, all of us gay people came together and fought for our rights. But there was that distinct divide between people mm-hmm. that could assimilate and people that had no choice.
Yes.
Society's never made room for trans bodies. It's not made room for black and brown bodies.
Exactly.
And that is really that divide that happened, that I think is why the people that are given no place in society, they end up filling these revolutionary roles because there's no option for them.
Right.
I mean, anybody that's condemning any amount of violence or any amount of what's going on with the current circumstances don't understand that we've given people no other option, you know?
Yeah. And as we can see, I mean, just from like the history of black and brown and queer people being illegal, like your existence is illegal,
right?
So therefore, when your existence is illegal, like the fact that you are alive is a revolution. When you have an identity, especially those identities that are intersectional of being a queer person and being a black person at the same time, just existing is a fight and a revolution on its own.
Absolutely. And I mean, ultimately, I would say personally, I'm so thankful to the people that were at the forefront of this, that fought for these rights, because honestly, having the ability to assimilate and assimilating, it's not the same as the oppression that these people faced, but it is a personal hell. And to some extent, you know, having that freedom to say, like, even if I could, I don't want to. Like, yeah. I want to be me, and I don't want... There's a role that you've given me that you say, if you follow these rules, you won't get murdered for who you are. You won't get abused for who you are. You won't get fired for who you are. It's like, but I don't want to have to follow these rules. I don't want to assimilate.
Right.
And it took the courage of those that had no choice, that mm-hmm. couldn't assimilate, that people like us can also not assimilate.
Exactly. And to add to that, like, even if you follow, there's so many examples of people who, like, black people following the rules, black queer people following the rules, quote unquote, and still facing violence because the rules conveniently change for them, or, you know, they're the violence and harm done to their physical existence is justified in some way. But you know, like, I think that's why, for me, I'm like, I don't really care if Marsha or Sylvia were at Stonewall, because, like, it doesn't really matter. They're still responsible. They're still responsible for our gay civil rights.
Right.
Like, no question.
It was definitely the marginalized people that led the movement that, you know, in turn gave rights to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I think that too often we in the white queer community assume that our queerness excuses us from having conversations about our own
white
racism. Yeah. Or, yeah, like I think that too often, like, well, I'm queer, I'm trans, I'm, you know, whatever. It's like, I can't be, like, that's like, right. I'm an oppressed person. It's like, but it's just you have to own that there is still privilege given to your body.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There are still so many, I've been having so many conversations with people in the bar community, just to kind of, we're booze podcasts, bring it back to what we talk about.
Yeah.
So many people in the bar community where, as I've kind of fought my way up the ladder, there are so many times, and it sucks to say, but it's true, where I have been performatively femme to get a job, to keep a job. Mm-hmm. I have ignored things. I have looked past inappropriate behavior directed towards me, directed towards others, because I felt like this is what I have to do to survive. And not like allowing like all of that to preclude me from engaging with just how deeply underrepresented Black and brown people are in the bar community, and how often they're relegated to bar backs, to right. support positions that, you know, we talk about, like, so many bar staffs, prominent bars that have entirely white male staffs, and they might have a token female, but it's not even, like, bridging the gap of how racist most, like, high-end bars can be.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, it's something that, you know, knowledge gets passed down, and if you're only passing it down to people that look like you, you're part of the problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So thank you to Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, and Storm DeLavier for giving us our gay rights, and for all of the work that they did, just all the work that they did.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about queer nightlife being a safe space for community and how important that is. And it's also important to remember that it's not always safe for everybody. And mm-hmm. the safety that we have is a privilege that was given to us by these heroes.
I think I would use that to sort of issue a challenge to my fellow bar managers, hiring managers, to make your bar a safe space. Yeah. Like, focus on that, be it by hiring queer bartenders, hiring bartenders of color, hiring trans bartenders. I think it's so important to have those safe spaces. And more we're seeing that you don't have to be a gay bar. You can, there are only so many gay bars that can survive in a neighborhood. I think that we need to try to be more proactive in making staffing and our clientele in return feel safe, like, in our spaces.
Yes, absolutely. That's a really good point. Thank you to Absurdist for our theme music. Thank you to all of you who are listening. Thank you to everyone who's donated to our Patreon for this month. And as per the announcement that we made last week, all of our proceeds from our Patreon in the month of June are going to the Okra Project. The Okra Project is a collective that seeks to address the global crisis faced by Black trans people by bringing home-cooked, healthy, and culturally specific meals and resources to Black trans people wherever they can reach them. So a really good work that they're doing, and that's what we are going to be supporting. And if you donate to our Patreon this month, you will be supporting that as well. And if you want to support them directly, go to www.theokraproject.com for more information on how to donate.
We're going to do a very special live stream this weekend. Stay tuned for further information, but it's going to be a different sort of thing for us. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Me too.
Happy Pride, Liz.
Happy Pride, Taylor.
Happy Pride to all of you. I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been
Neat. Oh!